Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. In this episode, we're going to look at a very pivotal moment in human history. A moment that has gone down as one of the greatest moments in Western human civilization. That moment is the last stand of King Leonidas of Sparta against the army of the Persian king Xerxes at the Battle of Thermopylae. Also, yes, I'm using the Greek pronunciation of his name instead of the Americanized version, Leonidas, because I spent my early days in COVID lockdown studying Arabic and Greek, so let me have this one thing. Of course, most people are probably somewhat familiar with this battle due to the movie 300. A bunch of buff guys in red fighting against what seemed to be insurmountable odds. However, who actually was Leonidas? And who actually was the great King of Kings who came for Greece with the hopes of conquest? Because Xerxes himself was also an incredibly prominent ruler who has gone down in history as Xerxes the Great. I've been wanting to do this episode for a very long time. When I was originally trying to figure out what kind of history show I wanted to do, a deep dive into both Leonidas and Xerxes was one of my options for a pilot episode. And now here we are finally doing it at episode 99. The background of the Battle of Thermopylae lies in the greater landscape of the Greco-Persian Wars, which was actually two separate invasions into Greek territories by the Achaemenid Persian Empire and further counterattacks by the Greek city-states. I've covered previous Persian rulers in this show, including the rise of King Darius, the man who instigated the first Greco-Persian War. However, we've never touched on this pivotal period. I once heard of the Greco-Persian Wars as the idea of Western versus Eastern dominance over global culture coming to a head. I think there might be a few problems with that train of thought, but it might not be entirely wrong. And while the Battle of Thermopylae was not the be-all, end-all fight, it certainly deserves to be recognized as a springboard moment for the Greeks, allowing for a flow of history that would eventually result in further Western powers rising up, like the Empire of Alexander the Great and the Romans. So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to the Eastern Mediterranean world of the early 5th century BCE in Leonidas versus Xerxes, the War for the West. In the background history lesson, let's learn about the first phase of the Greco-Persian Wars. So, our main historical source for the Greco-Persian Wars is history's favorite punching bag, Herodotus. He was a Greek man who was one of the first guys to write history in a way that made it more of a story than just listing dates. He traveled around and asked locals stories about their past. That means that, unfortunately, a lot of what he wrote is not true and just local superstitions. However, there's actually a lot of stuff he did get right. He was born just after the second phase of the Greco-Persian Wars, the stuff that will make up the main story of this episode, and he was able to interview a lot of Greeks who fought in that war. This means that most people give Herodotus a pass when it comes to this time period. The only thing he probably wasn't right about is the number of soldiers on each side for battles, but that's not super important for right now. Anyway, the Greco-Persian Wars really got their start with the rapid expansion of the Achaemenid Persian Empire and it butting up against the Ionian League, a group of city-states in western Turkey that were part of the Greek sphere of influence. I recently did an episode about the first Achaemenid emperor, Cyrus the Great, so listen to that one if you haven't for some more info about that. A little before Cyrus rose to power, the Ionians came under the control of the Lydians, a kingdom within western and central Turkey. The Lydians offered Ionia a fair amount of autonomy, but they were still part of the greater empire. Well, Cyrus the Great ended up conquering Lydia around 547 BCE. During his conquest, he attempted to get the Ionians on his side, but they refused. So, after the Persians held the main body of the Lydians under their control, Cyrus further attempted to pursue control of the Ionians. This kind of failed, with the Ionians desiring the same autonomy as they had under the Lydians, while the Persians just wanted them to fall in line. Well, a few kings of Persia later, the Achaemenid Empire was continuing to expand under the rule of Darius the Great. The Ionians became increasingly exasperated with their situation. One of the Ionian leaders, Aristagoras, was on a Persian expedition that went sideways. He realized that Darius would probably replace him with a different leader and decided to instead launch a full-scale revolt in 499 BCE, getting the other Ionians to follow suit. When city-states within mainland Greece heard about their fellow Greeks rising up in revolt, some of those city-states, like Athens, gathered together to lend a hand against the Persians. While Persia ultimately brought Ionia back under its control, Darius vowed that the other Greeks would pay for their aid in the uprising. In 492, Darius ordered a full-scale invasion of Greece. His army managed to gain submission from the regions of Thrace and Macedonia. Several other city-states within the Greek peninsula also followed suit, with the two notable exceptions maintaining independence being Athens and Sparta. In 490 BCE, the Athenians beat the Persians at the Battle of Marathon, which is in fact where we get the term for a marathon run from, due to a messenger apparently running from Athens to Sparta to ask for aid in the battle. This defeat forced the Persians to retreat, but Darius quickly planned for a second invasion into Greece to fully bring it under his control. Unfortunately, further revolts broke out across the Persian territories, and the King of Kings, the Persian term for their leader, was forced to deal with these conflicts. But before he could ever turn his attention back to Greece, Darius passed away in 486 BCE. His son, Xerxes, would inherit the throne as Xerxes I, and he was very much keen on succeeding where his father had failed. We should probably talk a bit about Sparta before we get into Leonidas' life. The city-state of Sparta is definitely one of the most famous Greek locations in history, but I think it's kinda gotten flattened out into, "We're soldiers and only soldiers, leave those silly arts and crafts to the Athenians." This is not necessarily wrong, but it has a slight bit more nuance than that. Not all of that nuance being good. But how about we talk about Sparta the location before we get to its people? In case you don't know, Sparta is a city in southern Greece on the Peloponnese Peninsula. While there is a modern-day city of Sparta, it's technically different from the city-state of ancient Sparta, even though it occupies the same area. And actually, the city-state itself was known as Lacedaemon, with Sparta being the main settlement within the region. The people were also known as the Lacedaemonians. Due to the stereotype that they were blunt with their words, this demonym eventually gave us the English word laconic, meaning someone who uses brief sentences to talk. The Spartans operated under an unusual government in that they had two kings co-ruling at once. These kings, one from House Agiad and one from House Eurypontid, both claim descent from the famous Greek hero Heracles, aka Hercules. The free citizens of the city operated under all the usual freedoms of the citizens of the other Greek cities, and it's thought that women were perhaps more equal in Sparta than they were in other places. However, free Spartan citizens were actually the minority within Lacedaemon. There existed two other social classes known as the Perioikoi and the Helots. The Perioikoi were formerly other Greeks living in the general region who had been subjugated by the Spartans. They weren't slaves by any means, but they had restricted freedoms compared to the group we call the Spartan citizens. They could hold political power within the cities of their own people, and as a unique trait, the Perioikoi could freely cross the border out of Lacedaemon, something not even free Spartans could do without permission. That leaves the Helots, who made up over half of the population in the region. I really want to say that the Helots weren't slaves, but I'm also not going to argue with anyone who'd say that they were. Like the Perioikoi, the Helots were once people in southern Greece who had been conquered by the Spartans. While they were not owned by private citizens like we usually think of slaves, the Helots were technically owned by the state. They were mainly manual laborers, as most of the free male population in Sparta were part of a standing army. This makes them fairly comparable to serfs in a feudalist society. It was apparently common for free Spartans to casually terrorize Helots. Besides injuring and killing Helots, Spartans would get them drunk and parade them around town to act as lessons for the children. While they had no political power and couldn't vote, Helots were allowed to own some small amount of personal property. It wouldn't be until well after the Greco-Persian Wars that the Helots rose up, with some even getting to pay their way out of serfdom. But as I mentioned earlier, a vast majority of the free Spartans, at least the men, were soldiers. There was a weird bit of mild eugenics going on in Sparta where people basically wanted to give birth to the best soldiers possible. This is why both men and women were given rigorous training from an early age. However, it is the boys who would undergo the most grueling training, which is known as the agoge. From age 7 to 21, a Spartan boy would train to become a soldier. While other subjects were part of the curriculum of the agoge, the main focus was combat. It's said that each boy was only equipped with a single cloak per year, which allegedly helped them get used to the messiness of war. Otherwise, they trained naked and barefoot. The system was absolutely horrific by modern standards, but was used to develop a sense of camaraderie among the future soldiers. A family who could not afford the tuition for the agoge was prone to losing their rights as free Spartan citizens. And on the flip side, free Spartans sometimes adopted Helot boys and paid for them to join the agoge. Any Spartan, or the rare Helot, who passed the agoge became a member of the standing army until they reached about 60 years old, when they were deemed too old to fight. Women were given their own education path called the musike. While it included combat training, it was also focused on art, poetry, and music. See, Sparta wasn't just a warring city-state, they also had the fine arts. Spartan women were among the very few, if only, Greek women who received a formal education. Sparta really made a name for itself in the Second Messenian War in the mid-7th century BCE. This was the war that saw Sparta come under the control of Lacedaemon. With their victory over the neighboring city of Messenia, the Spartans became known as one of the greatest armies in ancient Greece. This allowed Sparta to gain supremacy over its other neighbors on the Peloponnesian Peninsula, though it would also extend a hand by creating the Peloponnesian League, a group of the city-states within the region who were to act as each other's military allies, with Sparta acting as the leader of said league. And it was within this era of Spartan supremacy, an era and location that prided itself on its super soldier boyhood program, that the future King Leonidas was born into. Leonidas was born around 540 BCE to King Anaxandridas of Sparta and his wife, whose name, despite my best efforts, I could not find. Now, Anaxandridas actually had two wives, but Leonidas' mother was his first. His mother was also King Anaxandridas' niece. For a while after the couple were married, Leonidas' mother seemed as if she could not bear any children. The Council of Sparta, a group of five nobles called the Ephors, approached Anaxandridas and told him that he should probably divorce his wife and find a new one who could give birth. In the oddly progressive manner with which Sparta treated its women, the king refused to divorce her, insisting that it wasn't her fault that she hadn't gotten pregnant. The F-Wars then agreed that he could just have a second wife if he wasn't going to divorce his first wife. This situation was apparently very much not the norm anywhere within ancient Greece. So, Anaxandridas found another wife, who again remains nameless in history. This second wife was said to be a descendant of a man named Kylon, a Spartan noble who helped his city rapidly militarize after the Second Mycenaean War and led for the formation of the Peloponnesian League. Given that he was an old man in the mid-6th century, this second wife was possibly his daughter or granddaughter. Together, Anaxandridas and his second wife had a son named Cleomenes. A year later, the king's first wife finally had a child, another son named Dorius. Later, Leonidas himself was born. As the third son of the king, he was in no position to ever inherit the throne unless something happened to his brothers. So, it is very likely that Leonidas was put through the agoge, which his half-brother would not, considering he was the king's heir. When Leonidas was about 16 years old, King Anaxandridas passed away, leaving the throne to Cleomenes as his eldest son. Dorius was outraged at being passed over considering he was the oldest child of the king's first wife. He decided to leave Sparta, sailed across the Mediterranean Sea, and set up a colony in northern Libya. Unfortunately, this colony would be destroyed, and Herodotus says Dorius's failure here was due to him not consulting with the Oracle of Delphi, the most important oracle in the Greek world. So, Dorius consulted with the oracle upon his return, and she informed him that he would find better luck in Sicily. He once more set out to western Sicily, which he heard had land that belonged to the descendants of Heracles. Dorius was involved in the goings-on in Sicily and southern Italy until he was killed around 490 BCE. Unfortunately for Dorius, Cleomenes committed suicide in 490 BCE without having any sons to take his place on the throne. There's a theory that Leonidas actually murdered him, but that can't be confirmed by any records. So, considering Leonidas's older brother had abandoned Sparta and was also potentially dead by this point, he was picked as the new king for House Agiad. And even if Dorius was alive, Leonidas was in a better spot to be king because, just like dear old dad, he too had married his niece, Gorgo, the daughter of Cleomenes. Also based on his approximate year of birth, that would mean he was around 50 when he took the throne as king. We don't know exactly what he was up to during that time, but he likely would still have been serving in the Spartan army and provided he took care of himself, and as someone who takes multiple martial arts classes with men in their 60s holding high-level black belts, that is something I can very much imagine. So we can just check in on what the army was up to. But before we go much further with Leonidas, we should probably learn more about our Persian king in the episode. As I said earlier, Xerxes was the son of King Darius I. His mother was the daughter of Cyrus the Great, which helped Darius secure his position to the throne of Persia as he was not a descendant of Cyrus, and probably killed a son of Cyrus to take the throne. Xerxes was born around 518 BCE and spent most of his childhood in the city of Babylon in modern-day Iraq. His early life was probably similar to that of other Persian nobles. So while we may not know exactly what Xerxes was like as a kid, we can at least guess at his upbringing. Because the Persians favored oral history over written history, much of our knowledge about their lives comes from the Greeks. Persian nobility's education comes to us from the Greek philosopher Plato. I don't know how accurate Plato's knowledge of Persia was compared to someone like Herodotus, but his writings were later confirmed as correct by the Greek soldier and philosopher Xenophon, who had a great deal of contact with the Persians and actually served under a Persian prince as a mercenary. Xerxes' early teachers and guardians would have been court eunuchs. Around 7 years old, he would have been taught equestrianism and how to hunt. Around 14 teachers with aristocratic backgrounds would take over to teach Xerxes further subjects as well as the tenets of Zoroastrianism, the monotheistic religion of the Persians. Finally, starting at 16 years old, he would begin his 10 years of training to join the Persian military, where he was then expected to serve an additional 25 years as a soldier. If he had not become the King of Kings, he would have acted as an advisor to Darius's heir. Well, as I said before, Darius the Great died in 486 BCE. Just before his death, revolts broke out across Egypt, which was part of the Achaemenid Empire. Darius had ordered many Egyptian laborers to be moved to modern-day Iran to help with construction projects around the Persian cities of Susa and Persepolis, and had raised significant taxes to help support those projects. Darius was about 65 around this point, but was still willing to lead the Persian army to force the Egyptians back into servitude. As per Achaemenid law, Darius had to appoint a successor when going out into combat. He named Xerxes as his heir. Just like with Leonidas, there was a brief squabble over this inheritance. Xerxes' mother, Atossa, was not the first wife of Darius. However, she was his first wife after becoming king. Darius's actual eldest son, Artabazan, argued that he should be Darius's heir. Ironically, in the grander context of our story, Xerxes' arguments for the throne were supported by a man named Demaratus, a Spartan king who had been exiled by Leonidas' older brother, Cleomenes. Demaratus argued that just because Artabazan was the eldest son of Darius did not mean he was the best choice, and that Spartan kings would not always name their oldest sons as their heirs if they thought another son was a better choice. Luckily for Xerxes, Artabazan eventually backed down from his claims. So, Darius set out to deal with the Egyptians. He seems to have been successful, but the campaign took a toll on his already failing health, and the King of Kings passed away. As Xerxes had been named his heir, he was quickly made the new ruler of Persia in autumn of 486 BCE. And before we find out how things went for him, let's once more jump back to Leonidas. So, what would Leonidas have gotten up to while serving in the Spartan army? Well, what could have been one of Leonidas' first big military outings was when Sparta decided to get involved with the politics of Athens. Back then, Athens was not yet a democracy, as it famously would become. It was under the rule of the tyrant Hippias. Also, I've mentioned this in a past episode over Athens, but should reiterate it here. A tyrant in ancient Greece was just anyone who took power in an unorthodox way, meaning not through election or inheritance. It held no negative connotations. There were good and bad tyrants alike. But a tyrant could also become a hereditary position, which is the situation with Hippias. His father was the tyrant Pisistratus, who had come to power through staging a coup against the traditional power structure of the city. Hippias's family was a rival to an aristocratic family called the Alcmaeonids. The Alcmaeonids were influential with the Oracle of Delphi. They convinced the Oracle to tell King Cleomenes that Sparta would not have access to the seer's powers if they did not kick Hippias out of Athens. Well, Sparta was trying to prove it was very powerful at this time, so Cleomenes ordered an invasion of Athens in 511 BCE. It's possible Leonidas served in this attack. Unfortunately, they failed. So the next year, Cleomenes ordered a second invasion of Athens. This time, they kicked Hippias out of the city and he fled to Persia. While Sparta attempted to revel in their victory, Athens decided that they would then try out this cool new idea called democracy. Cleomenes was not happy about that because he viewed democracy as undermining Sparta's accomplishments. The Athenians, upset at Cleomenes being upset, would then even go so far as to claim that the Spartans weren't the actual reason Hippias went into exile. Cleomenes then threw his support behind a nobleman who was friendly towards Sparta when the rest of the city decided to revolt. The Athenians overcame the Spartans and their allies, and the latter were forced to return to Lacedaemon. In 506, Cleomenes once again called for a war against Athens in an attempt to put his Athenian puppet tyrant on the throne. Cleomenes called upon the Peloponnesian League to fight against Athens, but the rest of the gang abandoned the Spartans when they found out why Cleomenes was calling for war. Even his co-king, Demaratus, the same guy who would go on to root for Xerxes, was against the war, so he recalled some of the Spartan army back to Lacedaemon. It's unknown whether or not Leonides would have stayed to help his brother. I'd like to think he did, just so I can briefly continue on with this thread. Athens and their allies easily overcame Cleomenes' army, forcing him to retreat. This caused Sparta and the Peloponnesian League to change things up to limit Cleomenes and his desires to control Athens. First, Sparta ruled that only one king could go on a military expedition at a time, hopefully limiting the amount of times Cleomenes was out of the city. Second, the League called for more equal representation as to not be blindsided by Sparta's actions. Later, Sparta actively chose to sit out the Ionian Revolt when Cleomenes discovered how far away Persia actually was from Sparta. Yes, that is the real reason. Throughout the rest of the 490s until Leonidas took the throne as king, the Spartan army mostly dealt with revolts on Peloponnesus, one from the region of Arcadia in the middle of the peninsula, and one from the Helots against the Spartan citizens. It's likely Leonidas took place in both. This meant that Sparta also did not take part in the first Persian invasion during the Greco-Persian Wars. Their claim to fame was kicking Darius's emissary down a well when he came to ask for their subjugation. So yeah, that scene in 300 actually would have been Cleomenes, not Leonidas. They even showed up late to the Battle of Marathon when Athens called for aid. The army arrived and basically said, hey, good job, Athens. Yeah, sorry, we were busy with an important Spartan festival, but yeah, congrats. Then, in 490, Cleomenes was imprisoned because the nobles thought he was insane. Kinda rightfully so. He had committed a lot of war crimes I needed to skip over here. He was found dead in prison after an assumed suicide not much later. Like I said, Leonidas then took power, and just in time for Persia to invade again. But hey, let me continue to tease that part of the story as we go back to Xerxes. In a great preview of how the rest of his rule would come to be known, Xerxes had to initially deal with yet another revolt in Egypt, just like that thing that had probably led to the death of his father. I've seen differing sources list this as either a second revolt or just the same revolt under Darius that had not fully been put down. Unfortunately, suppressing this revolt meant that Xerxes would have to push off his desire to reinvade Greece and get revenge for the failures of dear old daddy Darius. In the summer of 584 BCE, just a few months after the revolt in Egypt was put down, the city of Babylon rose up in revolt. This was due in part to Xerxes being a different type of king to that of the previous rulers of Persia. Cyrus had acknowledged that he was leading different ethnic groups and more or less gave them some respect, though that's often been overhyped. Cambyses, Cyrus's son and successor, and Darius were also kind of aware of this. Xerxes was born over a decade after Cyrus's death, meaning he had always lived in a world where Babylon was a part of the Persian Empire and subservient to it. He was not willing to give proper rights to a city the Persians had once considered a great boon to their domain. So, even though he was able to quash the Babylonian rebellion, it shouldn't be a complete surprise that Babylon rebelled again 2 years later. However, after this attempt, which Xerxes managed to put down, Babylon lost a bit of its prestige, at least in terms of how Xerxes perceived it. Before the 482 BCE rebellion, the Persian rulers were the king of Persia and Babylon. It seems that after this event, Xerxes stopped calling himself the king of Babylon, even though he was still very much its ruler. Like his father, Xerxes continued numerous construction projects around the Iranian cities of Susa and Persepolis. Two other major construction projects were also undertaken to help with the eventual invasion of Greece. If Xerxes was to lead a massive army that would make the Greeks quake in fear, he would need ease of access into the Greek mainland. One of these projects was creating a pontoon bridge across the Hellespont, aka the Dardanelles or Gallipoli Strait, which is a small stretch of water separating the northwestern corner of the Asia Minor Peninsula in Turkey to northeastern Greece. Another massive undertaking was digging a canal near Mount Athos in northeastern Greece. During the first invasion, a few hundred ships had been sunk off the coast due to strong headwinds, resulting in what Herodotus claims to be about 20,000 deaths. Obviously, can't have that happening again. To round off Xerxes' preparations for war, he once more sent envoys out to all the Greek city-states, except for Sparta and Athens, asking them to submit to his might. Obviously, those two cities would never submit to him. Sparta had even killed the last guy sent under Darius. The Greeks had already been anticipating a second invasion for several years now, meaning Sparta and Athens, despite everything that had been happening between them under Cleomenes, were gathering their allies together awaiting the Persian army. Over the winter from 481 to 480 BCE, Xerxes gathered his army in Asia Minor. Finally, as spring came around in April, the Persians began marching, beginning the second phase of the Greco-Persian Wars. As Xerxes and the Persians marched through northeastern Greece, the anti-Persian coalition came together to discuss how best to prevent the enemy from pushing further south. They agreed that the best place to stop them was a location called the Vale of Tempe, a valley in eastern Greece just south of Macedonia. However, once the Greeks had organized in the Vale, Herodotus claims the army was about 10,000 soldiers of combined Athenian and Spartan background. King Alexander of Macedonia, not that Alexander, met them to basically say, "Hey, the Persian army is so much bigger than you could imagine. They'll just circumvent Tempe and march south." At this point, Macedonia was a vassal state of the Persians, but they were mostly autonomous, so that's why Alexander could do his thing here. This information demoralized the Greeks, so they retreated to come up with a new plan of action. The Greeks' second plan of action, which is the one they'd go through with, is attributed to the Athenian politician Themistocles. He suggested a two-army approach to defending southern Greece. A naval group led by Athens would block the Strait of Artemisium, which was off the eastern coast of Greece and was a likely path of Persian advance. Themistocles had been spending the past few years heavily building up the Athenian navy, so of course he would suggest that. Meanwhile, a second army would block a narrow pass further south of the Vale of Tempe. It was the quickest and main route south to the larger cities of southern Greece. This place was known for its sulfurous hot springs, and so it was given a name in ancient Greece that meant hot gates. We know this pass as Thermopylae. While Athens had spent years building up its navies, Sparta had spent that time pushing its agenda to prove it was the greatest land army in the Greek world. Themistocles made Lacedaemon put its money, or spears I guess in this case, where its mouth was and asked the Spartans to block Thermopylae. Even if they were vastly outnumbered, the size of the pass would funnel the Persians into what was presumed to be a Spartan high-speed killing machine. When news of this reached Leonidas, he was hesitant to agree. He knew the stories of the Persian army. However, he also knew it was his duty as a Spartan, a king, and a Greek to protect the Hellenic world. So, he decided to consult with the Oracle of Delphi. The seer informed Leonidas that he had a choice. One, he could do nothing and Persia would destroy his domain. Or, two, he could stand up against the Persians, in which the Persians would lose overall and his name would go down in history. Unfortunately, he would die in the battle. So, going according to his duty, possibly knowing full well that he was about to die, Leonidas gathered his soldiers and began marching north. The pass at Thermopylae at the time of the Greco-Persian War was about 100 meters wide, with mountains on one side and the Malian Gulf on the other. According to Herodotus, Xerxes was marching with an army of over 2 million soldiers. This number is almost certainly highly inflated, with modern historians believing the number to be less than 300,000. Even with that much smaller number, Leonidas's troops were vastly outnumbered. And how many troops did Leonidas have? Yeah, we all know that number, right? 300 Spartans. Well, he had 300 free Spartan citizens. He also had other soldiers from Lacedaemon who were Perioikoi and Helots. There were around 1,000 of those guys. Then, you also had soldiers from other cities in southern and central Greece. The exact number of soldiers is not really known, but average estimates suggest Leonidas would have led an army of between 6 and 7,000 soldiers. However, this size disparity was not necessarily a deficit for Leonidas. As I said, Thermopylae was relatively narrow. There is no way you can march an army like Xerxes's through the pass as a massive wall of death. The terrain would also have been pretty different from what the Persian forces were used to fighting around. While both Greece and the general region the Achaemenid Empire ruled over were both mountainous, the region around Thermopylae was a combination of unforgiving rugged land and marshes. The actual date of the Battle of Thermopylae is also unknown, though it's usually said as taking place in August of 480 BCE. The Persians would have arrived at the pass to see a wall of Greek shields blocking their way. Xerxes, figuring that his seemingly endless army would pummel this opposition, apparently called out to the Greeks that if they surrendered their weapons to him, he would let them live. To this, in a line that has since been immortalized, for better or worse, Leonidas responded, "Molon labe," which is usually translated as, "Come and take them." Let me briefly go off on a tangent here. First, Plutarch, another ancient Greek historian, wrote that line in a way that would have represented his dialect of Greek, not the dialect of Doric Greek, the Greek of Peloponnesus that Leonidas spoke. So that phrase is not actually what he said. That being said, these recorded words have been echoed countless times throughout history, such as during more modern wars Greece participated in. Here in the United States, the phrase, usually still spelled out in Greek, has been co-opted by gun activists who are against firearm control laws. I used to drive by a house all the time that had a Molon Labe flag hanging out in front of it, and that house also had a bunch of other alt-right symbols on flags, so I just assumed it was the same thing without looking into it. And now that I know what it means, it makes even more sense as to why that was there. Now, knowing that the Greeks were not going to stand down, Xerxes ordered for his archers to fire a volley onto the human wall. From that distance, possibly about 100 meters away, the arrows bounced off the Greeks' shields and helmets. The Persian king then ordered an initial wave of soldiers, possibly around 10,000 strong, to take down Leonidas and his men. The Greeks had much larger shields they could use to form a wall and used longer spears than the Persians. So Xerxes was very surprised when this first wave of his fighters were mowed down without breaking the Greeks' formation. Xerxes then ordered his special heavy infantry soldiers, the so-called Immortals, to march forward. Unfortunately, just like the last group, the Immortals were pushed back. This fighting lasted all day, and the two armies broke apart for the night. The second day went much the same as the first. Xerxes would order for a group of his army to march forward and fight the Greeks, only for that group to be killed or pushed back. However, that day, Xerxes was approached by a Greek man named Ephialtes. Perhaps enchanted by the stories of Persian wealth, he decided to betray the Greeks in hopes of receiving a reward. No sort of reward had ever been offered, so this guy was really just going for it based on his own assumptions. He told Xerxes that there was a second pass around the mountains the Persians could use to get behind the Greek army, in which case the Persians could encircle them and destroy Leonidas's men. Xerxes sent one of his military commanders to see if this was the truth. As for Ephialtes, he was not given a reward. Again, because there was no reward in the first place, and he was forced to go into hiding. He was killed around 470 BCE, and Sparta gave the men who killed him a reward for the traitor's death. And so the second day of fighting came to an end. At the beginning of the third day, a local group of Greeks heard rustling in the woods and discovered it was the Persians using the second pass. They retreated and warned Leonidas's army of the incoming second group of Persians. Knowing they were about to be surrounded, Leonidas gathered his troops. He said that anyone who wished to retreat was free to do so. They could march further south and aid the other Greek armies. Of the possibly 7,000 soldiers who arrived at Thermopylae, only 2,000 chose to remain. Sure enough, the Greeks were soon surrounded, and Leonidas chose to fight in the rear guard to protect the other Greeks who chose to retreat. On that third day, the Persian army fought until they killed every last one of the 2,000 Greeks at Thermopylae. The exact number of Greeks who died throughout this entire endeavor is unknown, but it's usually not listed as being much higher than 2,000. As for the Persians, about 20,000 casualties are listed on their side. Leonidas knew he was on a suicide mission but chose to stick it out. And though he may have lost, by using his army as an incredibly efficient war machine, he managed to heavily cripple the Persian army. Sure, Xerxes could march further south, capture the region of Boeotia, and even destroy the city of Athens. But his losses could not win him the overall war. In September of 480 BCE, the Persian fleet was defeated by Themistocles and his navy at the Battle of Salamis. Fearing that the Greeks would then destroy his bridge across the Hellespont, thereby trapping the Persian army in central Greece, where they could then be surrounded and killed like Leonidas's army, Xerxes decided to retreat back to Asia. It's also said that yet another revolt had arisen in Babylon, meaning Xerxes had to put that down or risk losing the city. Overall, he was really in a bad position. So even though he had raised hell to get revenge for the failures of his father, Xerxes was put in the exact same position. The Persians had technically lost this phase of the Greco-Persian Wars. There would not be another Achaemenid invasion of mainland Greece. The rest of the Greco-Persian Wars, which lasted until around 450 BCE, were Greek counterattacks. In 477 BCE, after the Greeks defeated the Persians at Byzantium, modern-day Istanbul, the regions of Thrace and Macedonia were freed from Persian control. The Spartan king Leotychides ordered for the Spartan war effort to end, thus putting Athens in charge as the head of the Greeks. Little did he know that this would actually bring the Spartans into an age of decline in terms of military power. By the end of the war, the Ionians, the group whose revolt had started this whole epic series of battles, were granted full independence from Persia. But what of the players in our story? Obviously, Leonidas was killed at Thermopylae. He was succeeded by his son, Plistarchus. Unfortunately, he died without having any children, meaning the bloodline of Leonidas died with him. However, Leonidas would obviously be remembered. Until at least the 2nd century CE, a religious cult of Leonidas existed in Sparta. Yearly games were also held in his honor, though only free citizens of Sparta could compete in them. As for Xerxes, he continued to rule over his empire for the next 15 years. Little is known about his reign after his war in Greece. It's probable that he continued putting down revolts and continued construction projects throughout his realm. In 465 BCE, his oldest son and presumed heir, Darius, was assassinated, presumably by Xerxes' chief advisor, a man named Artabanus. Artabanus then also killed Xerxes in the same year. The throne of the Achaemenid Empire passed on to another of his sons, Artaxerxes. Under Xerxes the Great, our guy, not his son Artaxerxes, the Persian Empire had achieved its largest expanse as it held control of northern and central Greece. After his death, the empire would begin to collapse. However, it would still be over a century before the Achaemenid Empire was truly defeated by yet another man from the Greek world, that man being Alexander the Great, thus bringing an end to the wars between the perceived powers of the West and the East. Well, at least for that point in history. I want to take a moment here before we actually end this episode to talk about this whole notion of the Battle of Thermopylae, and the whole Greco-Persian Wars for that matter, as the dominance of Western culture over Eastern culture. For starters, what does Western actually mean here? Because in modern days, when you think of the global West, most people probably wouldn't think of people living on the western shores of Asia Minor like the Ionians as Western. I know it's actually this whole concept of this perceived passing of the torch from ancient Greece to Rome to the countries of Western Europe to the United States, but it's just all so dumb. America isn't the inheritor of the Greeks. Heck, the modern-day nation of Greece is barely the inheritor of the Hellenic city-states. They just happen to occupy the same area. Gun nuts in the US bearing symbols of ancient Greek culture don't understand why Leonidas said Molon Labe. Hey, if you want to be the ancient Greeks and Romans so badly, take on an underage boy to be your lover. Oh wait, is that weird? Man, maybe that culture isn't something you should want to aspire to then. Maybe you should study history. In my opinion, the inheritance of the West seems to be directly tied to what was once a major thought permeating cultures like Greece and Rome, the so-called decadence of the East. To them, people like the Persians were more effeminate, with thoughts that the men wearing makeup and perfume made them weaker. The Greeks watered down their wine while the Persians did not, which made them drunken fools to the Greeks. The Greeks were manly men who were soldiers from birth, refusing to acknowledge that the Persians were also the same way. If anything, the idea of Western culture should actually be the idea of toxic masculinity. The eugenics program of the Agoge in Sparta was Western culture. Mass conquest and decimations as key aspects of the Roman military was Western culture. Roman Catholicism only allowing men to be major religious leaders is Western culture. So, actually, I take back my earlier comment. The United States, a country where you can easily hear someone say, "We can't have a woman elected as president," is truly the inheritor of Western culture, and that's not something you should be proud of. By the way, if you found that annoying, you should be grateful that I deleted a completely different rant that went on for much longer and was much more cringeworthy. But I stick by my word saying this, and again, you should not be proud. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. Next time, it's episode 100 of Royally Screwed. That also means it will be the final regularly scheduled episode of this show. So, who gets the grand honor of episode 100? Well, I should probably make the About section of this podcast accurate. We know how a man tricked his way into becoming the Tsar of Russia. I answered if Caligula actually waged war against the ocean. However, we have one final question. Was Alexander actually great? Yep, it's time for one final Were They Great episode as I tackle the most famous one of all, Alexander III, King of Macedonia. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.